Blog Talk Radio.
Ooh. Yeah. You already know what time it is. It's that official time. When we take this worldwide. Let's go. Listen.
So now it's time to turn it up. Surf the radio waves as we begin to burn it up. We all up in your area like landscape, definitely bringing you the power slamming pancakes. It's the mandate that you tune in. It's time to move out so we can move in and recognize that this is no illusion. I'm here to clear the air so that there is no confusion. It all started off in the book of Genesis when Jacob was wrestling with who he thought was his nemesis. And when the man saw he couldn't overpower him, he touched his hip but he really could have devoured him. And from that point then we hear a name change, rearrange the game, so now we gotta change. So I'm here to let you know it's time to listen to the Pancake and Power Slam Show. Let's go!
Listening to the Pancakes and Power Slam Show by Crave Wrestling on Blog Talk Radio. Be sure to follow Crave Wrestling on Twitter at Crave Wrestling and join the Facebook fan page Crave Wrestling.
Indeed. It is the Pancakes and Power Slam Show. I am Chris Featherstone, your host. As always, we're going to have a great time. This is amazing. Every week we have a fantastic time through many of the social media outlets that we are on. Episode 179 with the one and only, I am pleased to announce our special guest host for tonight, Mr. David Pinzer. How are you tonight, sir?
I'm good. I didn't know I was a guest host. Thought I was just a
guest.
That's cool.
You are a guest and a guest host and a host of a guest and everything in between.
I'm sure
you've hosted many things.
Yes,
awesome. It's good to have you tonight, sir. So you're from New York, right?
I was born in New York, but I grew up in South Florida.
Okay. How long were you in New York?
I was six when we moved.
Oh, okay. So you were six. So you grew up in Florida. Are you big into, I know you're big into wrestling still based on your tweets, but were there any other sports that you were into?
I got into wrestling when I was 13 years old, I want to say. It was 11 years old. And it was 1977 Championship Wrestling from Florida. It's funny, I'm on a Facebook group, I guess, that I joined, and they send out old Championship Wrestling from Florida clips and shows. And right before I came on, I was watching a clip from 1977. It was the Florida Tag Team Champions, Ivan Koloff and Pat Patterson, on a TV match against Rocky Johnson, the Rock's dad, and a guy named Tony Rocca, who was sort of a preliminary wrestler back then. And they did Rocky Johnson won, and the enhancement guy, Tony Rocca, was going crazy. And I'm not sure, looking back, if they did that to set up a title match, probably, to try to give a little jolt to this guy. But it brought back so many memories. I was 11 years old. Heck, I'm 49 now. So you do the math. But I got turned on by my cousin to Championship Wrestling from Florida. It was on Saturdays, Channel 6. And UHF 33, and it was on at noon on Saturdays, and it was must watch every Saturday afternoon for me up until like 1984, 1985, when Crockett bought him. I think it was actually 87 when Crockett bought him, but I really wasn't into anything else back then. Watched a little baseball. It was a totally different world. There was six channels, so, you know, If Monday Night Baseball was on, and yes, there was a Monday Night Baseball, you know, and another thing is most people didn't have TVs in their, I hate to wax nostalgic, but most people didn't have TVs in every room. So you pretty much watch what your mom and dad wanted you to watch.
Yeah.
So, but my little gig was wrestling. And, you know, so that TV on Saturday afternoons, that was mine.
Nice. So CWF fan, that's awesome. So I'm sure that you were very aware and very familiar with the Texas Outlaws and Murdoch and Dusty Rhodes. So you were familiar with Dusty when he was a heel, right?
Oh, no. He turned in 74, and I started watching
74.
Maybe 75. I started watching in 77. No, he was on fire as a babyface. You know, they had wrestling down in Miami. I lived in Fort Lauderdale. They had wrestling in Miami back then on Wednesdays at the Miami Beach Convention Center. And Dusty would pretty much always headline, you know, those shows because, you know, 5,000 people. But there was a little place called the Fort Lauderdale National Guard Armory. I still remember where it was, but it's not there anymore. It wasn't air conditioning, probably held 800 people packed. And we'd usually get four matches. You know, you see these shows now, and, you know, you could imagine four matches on a Friday night because I didn't know it at the time, but the other crew went up to Tallahassee. So Tallahassee would get most of the talent. But three or four times a year, Dusty Rhodes would come to Fort Lauderdale, and it would sell out before, like as soon as it was announced that night, you know, that Friday night, if they announced the American Dream Dusty Rhodes was going to be here next week, boom, intermission, tickets were gone. And
wow.
So, yeah, he was on fire. And you know, I hate to talk about Dusty because it's still crazy, you know, that he's gone and so soon. But, you know, he was one of my heroes growing up, and then I got to work with him and for him. And, you know, that one, out of all the deaths that we've had in this crazy business, that one kind of hit me the hardest. But
I agree. I agree. I would say the same thing because, you know, I was a big Dusty fan as well. I mean, of course, I didn't work with him like you did, so I'm sure that there's some, you know, indelible moments that he shared with you. Can you think of anything in particular?
Well, the thing that I think is the coolest probably is when he was booking WCW, he thought, and even after he was booking, when he still had some influence, he wanted to make me a play-by-play guy. As a matter of fact, I did do play-by-play.
Oh.
Most people don't know this, but in 1999, not 2000, I did the play-by-play for the international WCW Monday Nitro. They were a week behind. So after we taped the night show, we'd come into the studio on Wednesday, and I would host it as Dave Lawrence with Larry Zbyszko. The reason I would call myself Dave Lawrence is because I'd be pitching to myself as the ring announcer. So, you know, and Dusty thought, you know, the sky's the limit. So, you know, you never know. If WCW was still in business, I might be, you know, the play-by-play guy at Monday Night Show. It was, you know, I was green as grass, but Larry carried me, and it was a pretty cool experience. I used to have that stuff on videotape, and you know, the million times that I've moved, I haven't been able to find it. So if anybody overseas listening has it, I'll buy it from you.
Absolutely. So how was it working with Larry?
Oh, Larry carried me. You know, you hear about you remember a guy like Eric Watts who was pushed when was really green, and it wasn't his fault. His dad was just trying to do him a favor, and he was really green. But you'd have a guy like Arn Anderson or even Larry Zbyszko when he was a wrestler, or Michael Hayes or Bobby Eaton, that would carry him, you know, to a good match. Well, Larry Zbyszko carried me to be a good, decent, serviceable play-by-play guy on international television. I mean, you know, if I was in there with somebody who had the same experience I was, we would have smelled the place up. Larry just, you know, said, follow my lead, even though I was the lead, but follow my lead and let's do this and have some fun. And we sat there, you know, and voice over a 2-hour show. It only took about an hour and a half without the commercials, but, you know, and we just have some fun, and we'd have a lot of fun with me pitching to myself, and Larry would be, you know, insulting me, you know, oh, that David Penzer, he sucks, he's hard, I don't even know how he has a job, and, you know, so we'd have fun with it. It was international, we still did a professional job, but yeah, Larry, you know, if for some reason that ever were to come of pass where, say, they were looking for another play-by-play guy, and I turned in a tape, and I happened to get that job, which never happened, but, a what if, you know, I would have had that job based on Larry, not based on me.
Wow. Interesting. So was it a matter of jockeying position for Shivani, or was he, you know, how was his feelings towards it?
Oh, Shivani was my boss. Shivani was the producer of the shows, and he was the one who decided, him and Eric decided, and Craig Leathers, who was the head of the department, decided who did what. So, no, Tony was fine. Tony knew that, you know, not only was he the lead play-by-play guy, but he was the producer of the shows, and so he wasn't going anywhere. You know, maybe he would have gotten promoted if this thing would have played out where he wasn't on air anymore and he was just like the executive producer. You never know. But no, Tony was fine. It was just, you know, I was signed to be a ring announcer, so you know they needed somebody to do this, and you know, and I guess I did it, like I said, a serviceable job where I didn't embarrass anybody. So I did it for a couple months, and I don't remember why I stopped. I think it was because they just decided to do it a day early, and I was still on the road doing Thunder. But no, it was cool. It was there, you know. It was really, you know, people talk about how crazy it was, and it was crazy. But as far as that went, you know, if there was any nervousness or back, you know, we all the announcers got along famously. We all, some of the best times I ever had was before Monday Nitro in the announcers' trailer with Lee Marshall, rest in peace, and Tony, Bobby Heenan, one of the funniest guy in the world, and Mike Tenay, who's actually, I think people are starting to realize now that they see the other side of Mike Tenay on Taz podcasts, and now he has his own podcast. He's one of the funniest guys too, you know, and Larry, and we just sit there and, you know, it was a privilege to be able to sit in that trailer and just hear stories and talk, you know, tell jokes, and you know, that's some of the coolest times I ever had. So that they were, you know, and Mean Gene, you know, talk about, you know, think about that. You got Larry Zbyszko, one of the best storytellers, one of the best interviews in the business back then. Mike Tenay, who has one of the wittiest dry senses of humor. Tony Schiavone, who's a great straight man. Bobby Heenan and Gene Okerlund, two of the funniest people in the world. Lee Marshall, who, you know, was so over the top, he actually provided comedic relief, you know, God bless him. So it was, we had a great time, and everybody got along, like I said, and you know, Mike and Gene and Tony and Larry and Bobby Heenan used to travel together. So there was everybody knew their place. Mike was the specialty guy who knew the Lucha Libre and the Japanese wrestling, and Tony was the lead. Larry was the baby face. Bobby was the heel. Lee was the over-the-top radio Tony Tiger guy. And I was the ring announcer. So everybody knew their place, and Gene was the best interview guy in the history of the business. So it was a good time. And I actually haven't thought about that in a while, sitting in that trailer telling stories. So I'm glad that came up. That, you know, some things you don't think about, but that was some of the funnest times I ever had. And I consider it an honor to be able to be in those in that trailer.
Yeah. You say that Gene Okerlund is the best interviewer. Who do you think the best play-by-play was? And, you know, your decades of wrestling knowledge, who is your favorite play-by-play guy?
You know, it's different. I think for what it was back in the early 80s, I think Vince McMahon, believe it or not, was really entertaining. I think Jim Ross, to call a classic match, Jim Ross is the all-time best. I think Mike Tenay has done a fabulous job when he was doing TNA wrestling, especially, you know, with some of the stuff that was being presented when they first started, some of the over-the-top stuff, and having to make that sellable to the average wrestling fan. And I think Tony was pretty undervalued. I mean, Tony is a baseball play-by-play guy. That's what he did before, and that's what he does now. And he came in and told stories and, you know, had a little ting of humor but didn't step on the other personalities. I think, and you know, and I can't have to say, watching that match on Facebook 15 minutes ago, 20 minutes ago with Rocky Johnson and Pat Patterson and Ivan Koloff, now that Gordon Solie is who I grew up on. And both championship wrestling from Florida and later Georgia championship wrestling. And, you know, you grow up on them and you take them for granted. And then you get on to some of the, you know, you have the JRs and the Vince McMahons who are a little bit more yelling and not, I don't want to say yelling and screaming, but excited. And Gordon Solie was never excited. But the irony is when you go back and you listen to Gordon Solie now, he was excited. He just sold it as a sport and never was over the top. And I'm not saying the other guys are over the top. They all have their styles. You know, just like Gary Capetta had a style of ring announcing, Howard Finkel has a style of ring announcing, Michael Buffer. You know, we all have just different styles. But, you know, Gordon Solie was just amazing at being able to tell a story with his inflections and his words and his back, treating it like a professional sport. And going back at 49 years old and listening again to it, now that I'm seasoned in this business, so to speak, and to be able to see it now with my eyes at 49 years old and listen to it is absolutely a thing of beauty. There was, not to go on and on, but there was an angle they put up there recently with Ernie Ladd, Dusty Rhodes, and Gordon Solie, and they showed like sort of like clips of the whole three-week angle or two-week angle. They're trying to find out if Ernie Ladd was coming to collect the bounty that Harley Race had put on Dusty Rhodes. Anyway, Ernie Ladd was amazing in the angles. Dusty Rhodes was over the top, but I would say Gordon Solie selling of those that angle was every bit as bit as equal to Dusty and Ernie Ladd's to get that angle over. It's just really
Solie
cool
was,
to be able to see that.
So Solie was definitely one of a kind. I mean, I've mentioned Solie many times on this show, and I've listened to Solie countless amount of times. Solie's funny to me. I definitely agree that he was very monotonous, and he had some inflections, but they weren't very distinct from his normal tone. Ric Flair with the belly-to-belly souplé,
I forgot about all that stuff. I love, social media, you could relive that stuff. And, you know, when Dusty passed, I was able to go back and listen to all the Dusty stuff. And I know that, his most famous interview is the, one from World Championship Wrestling where he was Flair talking about hard times. I still think the best one ever is the one where he and Dustin were talking about how he was going to be Dustin's partner against Terry Funk and Arn Anderson. What was the promo? I don't remember the theme of the promo, but I'm going back. I still think that's the best one. But getting back to Gordon, yeah, really one of a kind. And he wasn't appreciated as much because there was really nobody to compare him to. But if you go back and you look, for those people that are watching that maybe haven't listened to Gordon Solie call a match, but they did back in their childhood, go back and Google it on YouTube and listen, because he wasn't excited. He wasn't over the top in any way, shape, or form. He called it like a real sport, but just the little things really sold, especially the angles. Just amazing, amazing stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. What about Lance Russell in Memphis area?
Oh, I forgot Lance. I knew there was somebody I was leaving out. You know, I got to work with Lance after WCW several different times. Corey Macklin, who's another person and personality in wrestling, who's passed away. He would promote with Jerry Lawler and Jimmy Hart, Legends of Memphis shows. They actually had a TV show for a while, and the producer of the show had no idea about it. It was a live show. Had no idea how to do wrestling. While I've never produced, I did work in production in WCW. So I jumped into the booth and took over the show. And, you know, the one nice thing Jerry Lawler has ever said to me, not that he said unnice things, but Jerry Lawler, if you know him, is not the kind of person to rub pleasantries in your face. He's kind of about Jerry Lawler, and I don't mean that as an insult. That's just how he is. And but he came. He told me afterwards, I saved the television show. That was a cool thing I got to do. But I got to work with Lance, and that was an honor. He was different, while he was over the top, it's amazing. You know, the personalities that this business has produced. You know, you think about people like Gordon Solie, like Lance Russell, Gene Okerlund, Vince McMahon, Jim Ross, Tony Schiavone. You know, it's funny, Tony did a great job, but he pales in comparison to I don't even know if he'd make the top 10, and he certainly deserves to, but there's just so many amazing personalities that have been in this business and are in this business. And, I think Tony would make the top 10, and I consider Tony a great friend, and I have total respect for Tony Schiavone, for what he did in front of the scenes and behind the scenes, and having to put up with a hard situation towards the end. But as far as having a, we could see the writing on the wall, but we still had to produce. But I have, don't spend a lot of time thinking about television personalities from behind the microphone, because you're so used to watching what happens, you know, in front of your, you know, what happens on the screen. But it's cool that we got talking about it, because yeah, it's really there's a lot of legendary announcers.
Yeah, it's funny because I watched a little bit of Lance Russell growing up, because I grew up in the 80s, and I watched some Memphis stuff. Not I didn't remember it so much in the 80s, and I remember his hiccup of a stint in the WCW in the 90s, early 90s, I think it was. I think it was 90 when he came, either 90 or 91.
I didn't come until like 93, so yeah, he was there before I came. I was up there,
yeah.
And I was working behind the scenes for a long time before I even was a ring announcer. But but yeah, he's one of the legitimately nicest guys I've ever met, and I met a lot of people. I mean, you know, he's just a super warm, nice guy. And I heard that Lawler and Terry Funk are wrestling one more time in Tennessee, and Lance Russell's going to be there. I wish I could. Wish I could move on over to Jackson, Tennessee, and check that out. But I got to earn a living. But Terry Funk is one of my favorite wrestlers growing up, and Terry, Dusty Rhodes, and Roddy Piper. And I got to work for two of them, and I got to know Terry really well. So it's pretty cool living your dream. It really is. I got to say, not everybody gets to live their dream, but at the highest level. But I did, and it's pretty darn cool.
Yeah, I remember. It's funny because as I was growing up, I didn't really remember too much of Lance Russell. I mean, I remembered him, but I didn't know too much of him to say a lot about him. But it's funny because this past year, I've been watching hours and hours and hours of CWA stuff. And it was just really, really interesting just seeing him and Dave Brown, on the table together. And just this has been, it was awesome just to see just that old school 85, 86, 87, 88 type of wrestling feel. I remember growing up with it, but just the Memphis feel and just how they would just, I mean, the video quality was so much different than now. You could just, a 30 to second to a minute, video package, and then you got so much social media, but intermittently they would cut into like a backstage segment when Lance Russell just start, throwing out different cities that they're going to be in. Yeah, we got a Dandy in Evansville, and it's awesome how that used to be the way to promote wrestling. And as the time evolved, it was different. But it's really good to just, as a traditionalist myself, watching wrestling for over 30 years, just to appreciate those times where we see what we see now. But as you're talking about with CWF and growing up that way, just seeing that type of wrestling and really appreciating it. What's your experience with AWA?
I didn't get to see a lot of AWA. It was I didn't get to see a lot of them. I think, like I said, Mean Gene is the best of all time. But as far as their play-by-play guys, I really didn't know them at all. The funny thing is the difference between Gordon Sully and Lance Russell, who are arguably the two best of that era, the difference between them was that – and Bob Caudill was pretty good too. But the difference between Lance and Gordon is that really the difference of the territories that they were in. In Championship Wrestling from Florida, it was produced as an athletic competition, and it was important to Eddie Graham at the time, who was the promoter, and the people in charge, to present it like an athletic competition. And Gordon Sully was very calm and very, dry. And if the heels, the bad guys were arguing with Gordon, he would just kind of say, "That's your opinion," and Memphis was sort of over the top, wild and wacky, breaking down and hard, way more hardcore than Florida was, and Lance Russell was, over the top. The heels would start arguing with him. He'd be like, "Well, come on, Jerry, you know better than that." That's ridiculous. Sort of almost argue with him. And it really matched the territories. And I guess that was the key back in the day. I've really become fascinated with territorial wrestling back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, because we're never going to see it again. And I think it was a really, really cool thing. And you know, I'm really, you know, watching a lot of that. And, you know, that's what made it special, is every territory was defined and different. And, you know, Georgia Championship Wrestling sort of combined both, and Gordon was able to settle in there as well. But, you know, it's just amazing to go back and see, you know, how these territories were run. And it's a shame that, you know, we only have, you know, really one company that's producing wrestling at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of a company, their competitor for many years, really six solid years, the Monday Night Wars was WCW. So you became a announcer. What year did you really become an announcer? It was in the 80s, right? It's late 70s, early
80s? No, 90s. I want to say probably 93. I became the backup for Gary Capetta. And then I think 95, 96. My timeline might be off, and I do apologize.
Well, not WCW. I'm talking about just period. Just when did you start? When did you know that announcing was what you wanted to do?
Oh.
You DJed for a while, too, right?
Yeah, I was a DJ. I worked as we had a high school radio station that I worked at as a DJ, and then I did bar mitzvah, sweet 16s, and weddings on the weekend when you had to haul all the records around. And then, I've told the story a lot of times, but make a long story short, there was a company called Global Wrestling Alliance based out of South Florida, Fort Lauderdale, that Bob Roop and the great Malenko were involved in. It was a penny stock company in 1986 when WWE made it big. And they sold penny stocks on the penny stock market, obviously. And there was a guy who ran it called Michael Brannon, who wrestled as Dr. Red Roberts and managed. And he did a gimmick down in the Indies in South Florida before he was running the Global Wrestling Alliance, where he was a psychologist, and he would come out and analyze as a heel the baby faces. And truth be told, he was a real psychologist, and still is, actually, in Fort Lauderdale. And my dad was also a psychologist, and one of the people that he had a counseling center that he had counselors that worked for him in the building. And one of those counselors knew Dr. Red Roberts and knew that I was really into professional wrestling. When they started the Global Wrestling Alliance, they got in touch with Michael Brannon, Dr. Red Roberts, and their first taping was in the Diplomat Hotel. And he said, come on out, and I came on out and watched it. They already had a ring announcer. And then when they did the second set of TV tapings, they had me come out and help them behind the scenes a little bit. And then they had a spot show in Palatka, I want to say, Florida, and main event was the Iron Sheik against Corporal Kirshner, and Ox Baker was on it, Adrian Street, Cousin Jr., and they had me ring announce it. First time I ever ring announced, first time I was ever in a locker room, didn't know what to think, but sort of started working for them as a ring announcer and behind the scenes and promoted some shows, and then when they closed, me and Bob Roop bought their ring and promoted shows around South Florida, and then we, when Bob got a call from Ole Anderson, who he had worked with when he was in the wrestling business, not in the wrestling business, worked with as a wrestler in the business, to be an agent for WCW, Bob went up and took that job and arranged for me to start booking enhancement talent for Florida and bring them up for Jody Hamilton, who booked the enhancement talent, who's the assassin. And that's how I started getting involved in WCW. I would bring up the enhancement talent, and while I was there, I was running guys for interviews and having different sheets signed, paperwork signed for the promotion, and it just kind of blossomed from there when they had an opening to ring announce.
Wow, that's awesome. So Shivani was instrumental in bringing you in as a full-time announcer for WCW, right?
Well, it's actually a kind of a funny story. I had Jim Ross. Remember, Tony was in. It was in WWF at the time, and Jim Ross was in WCW. And so I had gone up to Jim Ross while I was walking around running guys for interviews, because he did a lot of the interviews. And I told him, you know, when we had a break, you know, hey, I'm a ring announcer. I do it independently. If you ever have an opening, I'd appreciate you giving me an opportunity, since I'm here anyway. And he said, sure, no problem. And so then he left the company when Eric started, and Tony, who was in the WWF, came back to WCW and sort of took Jim Ross's place behind the microphone and then also in the production side. He was in charge of a lot of the interviews and stuff like that. So one day Tony walked up to me before I got a chance to talk to him, and he said, "Hey, you're the guy who brings up the wrestlers from Florida, right?" And I said, "Yeah, you know why?" And he said, excuse me. He said, "Well, I got a guy who used to ring announce for WWF, and we wanted to give him a tryout because we have an open position for the backup ring announcer, second string. Do you think you could bring him up next week so we don't have to fly him?" Excuse me. I apologize. And so my heart sunk. And I said, "All right, Penzer, it's now or never." So I said, "You know, I'm happy to do that, but I do want to tell you that I had talked to Jim Ross when he was doing what you're doing, and I had told him that I'm also a ring announcer, and I'd love an opportunity." And he said, "Well, I, you know, appreciate you speaking up. We'll give him a tryout next week. His name is Dino Puglia, and then you could do the week after." So we both worked. We both were okay. It was one of the scariest moments of my life because for years I had been up there telling guys, wrestlers and behind-the-scenes people, Jody Hamilton, all these people, you know, I could ring announce. So if I couldn't ring announce, not only was I not going to get the job, but I probably wouldn't have ever came back because at that point my whole reason for going up there for very, very little money was to work my way into a ring announce job. So it was nothing or everything. And I think I won by default. Nobody ever said anything, but I think they figured, look, they're both okay, but Penzer's here anyway, and we don't have to pay a plane ticket, and Dino's not, so let's just use Penzer since he's already here. So that's how I got the gig, and I did the house show, the B house shows, and then I did the syndicated tapings for WCW Pro and WCW Worldwide, and then Gary Capetta did the A house shows and WCW Saturday Night.
Gary Michael Capetta, I'm sure you got some stories about him. The world's most dangerous announcer.
Gary was a good guy. Gary kind of kept to himself. You know, I was one of the guys who would, you know, I would try to get to know the wrestlers and, you know, go down to the bar, you know, in Atlanta after TV when we did back to back and have a few cocktails and just kind of observe, you know, what was going on and sink it all in. And Gary, you know, stayed to himself. He was a friendly guy. It just wasn't very sociable. He was older, I guess. And but he was very instrumental in helping me, you know, prepare for, you know, when he knew he wasn't coming back, prepare for that spot. And, you know, he just was a great mentor, and I owe him a lot.
So do you remember the first, like, pay-per-view that you announced in WCW?
Yeah, it was in Columbus, Ohio. I forget the name right now. I want to say, But, yeah, and I heard a funny story after the fact. Eric Bischoff was counting on Michael Buffer being there to be the main event ring announcer, which, you know, Michael Buffer always used to come and do Let's Get Ready to Rumble. And for whatever reason, at the last minute, Michael Buffer couldn't come. And I guess that Eric panicked because I had never done a pay-per-view before and he didn't want me doing the main event. So he actually offered Gary Capetta, like I think somewhere between $2,000 and $3,000, to come in just to do the main event of that show because he wanted somebody other than me to do it. And Gary, at least the way Gary tells it, Gary said, "No, you wanted Penzer. You're going to stick with Penzer. I'm not going to come back and play this game." And I appreciate that because who knows what would have happened if that would have happened. But he went with me, and I did okay, I guess, and I stayed there. So I didn't know that story at the time, or else I probably would have had a panic attack over it.
Yeah. Do you remember any, like, specific times where you just botched, you know, like a big announcement or just fumbled?
I don't remember in WCW. I was pretty darn prepared. I do remember when we did the XWF down at Universal Studios. I don't know if you remember the XWF.
With Jimmy Hart, right?
Yeah, yeah, and that's the reason I'm in Tampa now. Because they moved me down here and I just kind of stayed. But I do remember in the XWF, I was doing talent relations and ring announcing and helping to produce the taping. So I was all over the place. We had a deal where Juventud Guerrero won the Cruiserweight Championship on one of the tapings. And I was actually running around. I wasn't even at ringside when when he won the title. I was running around trying to find somebody. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I announced, "Ladies and gentlemen, the winner of the match and new WCW Cruiserweight Champion."
Oh,
Juventud Guerrero. And I didn't even realize it at the time because I was running around with a microphone, a cordless mic, and I could hear, you know, what was going on in my IFB, which, you know, the little thing you wear in your ear. But that's the one that stands out the most. But in WCW, there are a couple of small things. But if you just keep going, usually most people don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
There was no getting around the WCW, except we just luckily it wasn't live, so only the people there.
Yeah.
And everybody laughed.
That's awesome. Well, you you became a very notable ring announcer in WCW. Now, I don't know how much you hung out in the back with the boys. Were you just one of the guys, or were you the ring announcer guy? Like, how did they perceive the ring announcers and other personnel that weren't wrestlers, typically?
You know, you have to win their trust. You know, at first, when I first got the job doing the B shows, I rode by myself. And then Randy Anderson, Pee-wee, the referee, took me under his wing and showed me the ropes. I think at first it was more because I got my hotel room paid. So he and my car paid. So and they had to pay for that. The referee and the talent had to pay for that out of their pocket. So I think Pee Wee figured, hey, I'll take this guy under my wing, and I don't have to pay for my portion of a car and my portion of a hotel. So I'll save some money, and it was a win-win. He got to save money, and I got to learn the ropes. And as me and Pee Wee traveled together, and you know, I learned about the business and the road, and you know, the road, you know, is lonely sometimes. And, you know, so, you know, you go out and have some cocktails or, you know, you hang, you know, whatever, you know, and just to kind of come down after the adrenaline of the night. You know, we don't finish till 10, 11 o'clock. And most people are usually finish work at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And by 10, 11, their adrenaline is kicked back down, but ours is still going. So, you know, you just learn the ways of the road. And then the guys, the boys finally, you know, started inviting me to different things, you know, and Pee Wee would bring me to the bar with them. And, you know, and then eventually Bobby Eaton would ride with us. And then in WCW, I would ride with different times Pee Wee. And then he left the company and I'd ride with Arn Anderson and Ric Flair. Probably the funniest year I ever had was traveling with Arn and Rick. Arn is the funniest guy in the one of the funniest guys. I know I call Bobby Heenan the funniest guy in the world, but him and Arn are pretty tied. And so hanging with Arn and then having Rick along, you know, and Arn to this day is a good friend. And so, you know, Rick's a good friend as well. I've seen Rick a couple times this year and, you know, I'm glad he's doing well. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you know, they consider you one of the guys, you know, the ribs that they play on the wrestlers are the same ribs I got ribbed on, you know, the rib in WCW Monday Nitro and on the road back in, 1998, 1999, I would come back to the, after I had a briefcase and I'd come back probably 2 days out of five on the road. I would come back to the locker room after the show and there was a padlock on my briefcase attached to something. And it got to the point where, before the as soon as I got to the building, I'd go find, the person that was in charge of the, you know, the tools in the building or the, you know, the, utility. And I'd make sure that they had a bolt cutter ready so that I didn't have to, you know, hang around too long after the show to find a bolt cutter. And in, at the TV tapings, they had a bolt cutter already waiting for me. You know, I never did find out who did that. I think it was Kurt Hennig, Kurt Hennig and Nick Patrick. But, yeah, you're just one of the boys, but you have to prove yourself, especially if you're a non-athlete. You know, I remember one of the guys, I forget who it was, came up to me, you know, probably, I forget who it was. It was a pretty big name, came up to me, you know, after he got to know me pretty well. And he said, you know, you deserve to be one of the boys. You know, you might not be tough when it comes to athletics, but you're out here on the road like we are, and you're doing your thing, busting your butt, and you deserve to be on the road, and you deserve to be one of the boys. It was one of the nicest things anybody said to me, actually. And now I can't remember who the heck said it. It'll come to me.
Yeah. That's awesome. So 2001 comes, and we see the unfortunate demise of WCW, and you were part of one of the last breed of people that were a part of the company before the purchase. Now, did you know anything, like, what was your personal take on it? Like, were you informed about a shift? Because I know that they were doing the Time Warner thing, the AOL Time Warner thing, and Bischoff, you know, there's many reports, and, you know, even he said before that, you know, he had something going on, but the investors pulled out. And so what did you know about the state of WCW before the purchase, and what were your feelings when it actually happened?
Well, the last year was pretty crazy, and, you know, the ratings were declining, the revenue was declining, the ratings were still pretty decent compared to what they were today, but, you know, based on what we had set the bar for, it wasn't good. They were losing a ton of money, so you knew at some point, you know, especially with Ted Turner losing his a lot of his power in his own company by merging, you know, because Ted would probably have kept the wrestling thing going just because it got him to where it was, you know, it got him to start, you know, to make his superstation so big, which led to CNN and TNT and all those different networks. But, you know, you sort of had a feeling that you were never comfortable that you were going to have a job in the long term. I really feel for the TNA guys, because I understand how it is. I've lived through it. I don't wish it on my worst enemy. But, you know, it was an uneasy feeling, but you just kind of had to do your job and hope for the best. And then Eric decided that he made an offer. There was a company called Fusent Media. I don't know that I've ever heard the name before or after, but they were going to purchase the company. So when that happened and they started doing their due diligence, Eric sort of came back, and while he wasn't on TV or anything, he kind of had a control of what the company was going, because if he was going to buy it, he wanted to be able to direct it the way that it would be sustainable once he bought it. And so Johnny Ace became his right-hand man, and I sort of became Johnny Ace's right-hand man, John Laurinaitis, People Power guy. And
People Power!
Yeah, and so the plan was, when Eric bought the company, I was going to go and be John Laurinaitis' right-hand man. So, you know, I was working in talent relations, and I was even sitting in on the booking committee in that time. And then we never heard that the deal with Eric fell through. The way I learned about the end of the company, basically, is somebody called me. I was at home and said, turn on WWF, I think it was still WWF at the time, website. And I turned on WWF's website. I'll never forget, the computer was in my kitchen in Peachtree City, Georgia. And I turned it on, and the splash page was the WWF logo. And then right in the middle, up in the left-hand corner, and right in the middle of the page was a big purchases. And then down on the right bottom right-hand corner, it had the WCW logo, the new one that they had done to look more futuristic. And my heart sank. And I had tears in my eyes. I ain't gonna lie to you. You know, when you get to live your dream and then possibly taken away, it's not a fun thing.
Yeah.
You know, but I went to Nitro in Panama City, and I decided I was going to do the best that I could do. You know, we didn't know at the time that Shane McMahon was going to be there. I did find out in the production meeting, but I decided I was going to lay it all out on the table and let the WWE guys that were there see what I could do and hope for the best. And if it was the swan song, I was going to enjoy it, and I did that.
Absolutely. So there were a few years between your stint ending in WCW and being acquired by and hired by TNA. So what did you do mainly at that time, and how did you get into TNA?
Well, I was moved to Tampa to work for the XWF. I was a salaried employee and ring announcer for their TV and their house shows. And so they moved me down here, and I came to work, and then that didn't work out. And so I didn't really know what I was going to do. I started a company called In Your Face Bookings, where I would book talent for independent shows. And that was somewhat sustainable. My wife had a job. And then I started, just out of the middle of nowhere, I started a company that had nothing to do with wrestling, but actually grew and became pretty successful in a very short time. So I figured that was it for me in wrestling. And, you know, wrestling kind of forgot about me. And I, you know, I always loved wrestling, but I just figured that was it. And Jeff Jarrett called me on the phone one day. We kept in contact, Jeff and I. And Jeff said, hey, you want to come? I'll never forget, I was at a birthday party at a bowling alley for my oldest son, and he called me on the cell phone and said, hey, you want to come ring announce? And I said, sure, you know, what do you want? What's the details? And he said, this is what we'll pay you, and this is what we want you to do, so get out the tux and come on down. So I came on down, because I lived in Tampa, and they were taping in Orlando. And I came down, and they said, you know, Jeff was very upfront. He said, look, Jeremy Borash has been with us through the thick and thin since the beginning of this company, and we're loyal to him. And that's a good thing. I'm glad they're loyal to him. He deserves it. And they said Shane Douglas was our interview guy, and Shane has some personal issues. He had to take some time off, get himself together. So we're going to move JB into the interview guy, and we're going to use you to ring announce. He said it could last a week, and, you know, you never know. But he said, I want to be clear. As soon as somebody comes to take the interview spot, you're moving, you know, we're not going to use you anymore because Jeremy's moving back down. And I said, I applaud the fact that you're loyal, and I'll be here for as long as you want me. You're paying me good money, and I live an hour away. So thank God Jeremy was so good behind the stick doing the interviews because they never did bring Shane back as an interview guy because Jeremy was so good at it. And so I ended up getting a 5-year run. So that was cool, and I still ran my business, but I had a couple of partners that could pick up the slack when I was in Orlando. Plus, I had a cell phone and computer with all the latest, you know, all the technology exploding the way it did. So that was a good little run, and then they decided to not have an interview guy in the back. They, if you remember correctly, at one point Jason Hervey was off camera asking questions right behind the camera, but you could hear him, and. So they decided, look, we're paying Jeremy a salary. He's not doing the interviews. So why are we paying Penzer a nightly deal when Jeremy's paying a salary and he's a ring announcer? So Terry Taylor called me and said, we no longer need you. It's not, you're not getting fired. It's a lateral move. And I said, thank you for the opportunity. And off I went.
And that was what, 2010?
Yeah, that would have been 2009, 2010. And it was a great opportunity. I never thought I'd have. You know, I got to reconnect with the guys and had some great times. Mike Tenay and Don West and Kevin Nash and Jeff. And, you know, got to work with Sting again, which was really cool. And who would ever believe in 2015, September, that Sting is going to headline a WWE pay-per-view for the World Heavyweight Championship. But good for him. He deserves it. He's a class act. But, you know, and so, yeah, that was my TNA run. I still can't remember who told me that I deserved it, but it's on the tip of my tongue. I can, like, see the guy, but I can't think of the name.
Yeah, well, you're at David Penzer, so I'm sure that you'll tweet it. There's a lot of people who listen to this show. So,
yeah, I need some more Twitter followers, man. You need to get me some Twitter followers.
There you go. What's your Twitter hashtag?
At David Penzer, and you could come and I call, because I come from Facebook, so I call it like, but you don't like, you follow. You could follow me, and you know, I don't tweet a ton. I'm not gonna to break your feed down, but come on and follow the old ring announcer. I got some wisdom left in me.
Absolutely. So real quick, before we go, what, based on your WCW tenure and WWE at this time, what would you say the big difference is between the two products?
Between WCW and TNA or WWE and TNA?
WCW and the current WWE?
I don't watch too much of the new WWE. I tape it and fast forward you know, WCW at the time really was about bringing the some of the legendary names back, you know, incorporating them with the feel at the time where, you know, you felt like there were, the NWO was the aggressor and trying to, you know, the, you know, you remember the storyline with NWO was portrayed to be, you know, Vince sending his guys over to get WCW and Billionaire Ted. And, you know, that was really cool. And it would never, nothing like that had ever been done before. We were playing off of their angle, their little vignettes. And, you know, you couple that with bringing in, you know, the high-flying luchadors that had never really gotten a chance in the U.S., and it was a different, cool, exciting style. And you know, the Japanese wrestling and the different short shoot style and the Chris Jerichos and, you know, so many personalities. I mean, you look back at the you know, the talent that we had, and it was pretty amazing. And, you know, WWE right now is sort of in a transition period. They, you know, they're trying to build around new guys like Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns, Dean Ambrose, you know, without getting away from, you know, the John Cena's of the world and the Triple H's. And, you know, so they're at, sort of at a crossroads too. But I think WCW at its heyday was, when it first started, was, you know, expect the unexpected. You know, Eric always had a trick up his sleeve, whether it was giving away the results of Monday Night Raw, which was pre-taped, or bringing out a guy like Luger, or you never knew who was going to walk out there, and we never knew who was going to walk out there. You know, Medusa throwing the WWE title in the trash can. It was an expect the unexpected, and it made it much watched TV in an era where where WWE was not much watched TV. I think that WWE got a bump recently because there was the big question mark, who's going to be, a couple of weeks ago on Raw, who's going to be the guy in the box? You know, I think they teased, you know, I didn't know who was going to be, and I thought it was cool that it was Sting, but I didn't know who was going to be. You know, Ric Flair came out, that Jon Stewart segment. So that's some of the expected unexpected, but very rare that I watch Raw live. You know, I'll throw back and forth to a Rays game because I'm a Tampa Bay Rays fan. But you know, so when they're in a commercial break, I'll pop it in and see what's going on. But very rare. But that last segment I watched live because I was curious, who was it? You know, because you know, I still remember watching Raw when Eric Bischoff walked out, and I couldn't believe it. I looked at my wife and I said, "Oh my God, hell's frozen over." You know, but that was a big deal. But Eric strove to do that every week. And that's what made them different. And WWE they're the only game in town, so they don't have places to steal talent from. You know?
Bischoff and Russo, like, were they easy to work with or no?
I really didn't work on, you know, at that close with those guys. You know, Russo seems like Russo is a very laid back guy. But you know, I didn't exactly agree with a lot of the things that his approach to writing wrestling, I wasn't a big fan of. But you know, Eric kind of, you know, kept to himself. Eric wasn't a big, "Hey, how you doing? What's going on? How's your wife?" And he'll admit that. He'll admit to this day he wasn't that kind of guy. He was a state. You know, he only really associated most of the time with the people he was friends with. And the you know, the top talent, because there was so much going on with the top talent, you kind of had to stick somebody in there to deal with them. But you know, so I really didn't get to work as close with them as to see what kind of people they were. You know, they were both laid back at production meetings and stuff. But you know, I know that I've seen Vince and I've seen both of them now actually in TNA, and I know in TNA. You know, it was funny seeing them work together after all this time. But in TNA, you know, they were Russo would fight. You know, the one thing is you got to pick your battles in this sport, in this business. You got to pick your battles to what you want to fight for. And I think they were both good at picking their battles to only fight for what they really believed in, and then just kind of do what the boss wants you to do in the other times.
Last question for you, David. So it's been about 5 years. Actually, it's been about 5.5 years since you've been gone from announcing, ring announcing. And, you know, there's still the WWE and NXT, but you still have TNA, and you still have GWF, Global Force Wrestling, and ROH. Have we seen the last of David Penzer as a ring announcer?
Well, you know, I'm still out there. I did the Legends of Wrestling at Citi Field. I'm working with that group, helping them behind the scenes. I think that they're working on some additional shows. So, I might do that. I'm supposed to be doing some college tailgate parties where they're having Legends of Wrestling come. It's a company, I don't want to say who it is because I don't know if they want it announced, but to where I'm going to host some Q&As, I believe, with them. I think I'm doing one in Miami and one in Gainesville. So, and if that works out, they're going to do it, every week at a different college stadium. So, have you seen the last of me on television? I would assume so. I'm 49 years old. I'm 25 pounds heavier than I was. It's a young person's business. It's a woman's business now. You know, you got Eden, Cody's wife, and you got Lillian, and it's just like I always tell people, in the NFL, most of the people on the sidelines are intelligent, good-looking women who know the business because, it's nicer to look at. You figure, a bunch of guys sitting around watching a game would rather look at an attractive woman than some guy in a suit and tie. So I'm cool with that. But, if I ever get the opportunity, I'll be grateful. But if I don't, I had a heck of a run. I live my dream, like I said. It's really, really cool to be able to live your dream and get to know your heroes as friends. And if I could only remember the name of the person who told me that, I would be a happy camper right now.
All right, well, I'll give you one more question.
I got it. It was Perry Saturn. How's that for timing?
There you go. Perry Saturn.
Perry Saturn,
perfect.
One of the toughest legit shoot guys who looked at me and said, Penzer, I had doubts about you. You may not take bumps, but you do everything we do, and you should call yourself one of the boys. And I said, Perry, I realized that years ago.
Absolutely. Last question. One other question just popped up. So what are your thoughts about TNA? Do you think that the direction is heading south, or do you think that they can rebound from this very tough time that they're going through right now?
Well, they sort of face the same problem as XWF did, which is that, at the time in the XWF, TV networks were down on professional wrestling and their ratings because WCW, they couldn't imagine why WCW, which was still in the Monday Night Show, was still one of the top 10 rated cable television shows. Why would you sell your company and put yourself out of business if you have a show that's doing in the top 10 cable ratings? There must be something that we don't. So, that was the mindset of the television networks. So it was really hard to get a network deal. Well, TNA, unfortunately, it all comes down to being able to pay the guys because you're not making any money on house shows. You're not making any money on pay-per-view. So the only legitimate way is to find a partner that's going to pay you to be able to sustain paying your talent, doing your TV. And XWF couldn't get that done, and there was a variety of reasons that have nothing to do with current TNA. Most of our stars ended up getting eaten up by Vince by the time we were ready to peddle the show. So we didn't. We had a product that wasn't that we couldn't. We had a product to sell that we couldn't deliver. It's sort of the same reasons. When Destination America, which is, and I mean no disrespect to TNA, I always wish them the best. But when Destination America, which certainly isn't one of the top cable networks, when they're not happy with you because you're the highest rated show, you're not appealing to their advertisers. How do you go and sell that to a different network? How do you say, well, it's just Destination America? Well, Destination America, Spike has let you go for whatever reasons. Destination America is not happy with you. How do you then go and say, yeah, but we want, $10 million a year, $5 million a year, $1 million a year. Maybe they could try to do something where they do it on a barter basis, but that's really tough. And if you're not getting the desired viewers as it is, how do you sell that? So they're just really in a horrible crossroads. And, you know, they were able to get on because wrestling sort of gained popularity. And, you know, if you remember correctly, they started out just doing pay-per-views. Then they were paying for their TV time, and wrestling started getting popular again. And all of a sudden the network said, well, maybe we'll give this another try. So, you know, that's how TNA was able to sustain. But now the same thing is really coming back to bite them in the rear, and it's a cyclical business. It always has been a cyclical business. You can't sustain 52 weeks a year of amazing television, especially with the same talent that's out there. You know, you see it on WWE, the even Steven booking and the, you know, the hard to make television stars, and you give them a push and then you pull off a push. It's not like the old days where you could bring up guys from other territories and make them into stars. You know, they brought up The Undertaker from, he was a middle card guy. Mean Mark Callis from WCW gave him The Undertaker gimmick. He became an instant star. There's nowhere to get those guys. To their credit, they've done the Performance Center, and they're starting to be able to have those guys now. But what? How does TNA do that? How does Global Force Wrestling do that? How does Lucha Underground do that? You know, and if you see, they're all having problems trying to make it work, which is unfortunate because this business would be better off with competition, and the more competition, the better, in my opinion. But it's a ratings-driven business, and if you're not getting the ratings and you're not getting the viewers that are paying for the advertisers, it's just going to be tough, and I wish them the best. I don't, you know, this business, like I said, would thrive on more companies out there, but it's a totally different business model than it was. The old days was, and I don't mean to ramble, but the old days was, you know, barter your television and then have them come out to the house shows to make your profit. Well, that's not the business model anymore. The business model changed with the Monday Night Wars. You don't have the squash matches and to build up to the main events at the house shows. You have the main event matches to build up to the bigger main event at the pay-per-view. And it's a tough model with all the channels that are out there today. And I guess the demographic of professional wrestling viewers is not the greatest, which is a shame because it's still a really cool sport. You know, to watch The Undertaker against Brock Lesnar, you know, was 20 minutes, probably some of the most exciting 20, 25 minutes I've seen as a wrestling fan in 10, 15 years. But that happens maybe once or twice a year. Everything else, you're just kind of trying to get to the next point.
Yeah.
But I still love this business, and I wish everybody well, and you know, I hope that everybody stays on track. I hope that Jeff could get TV or media of some kind, and I hope TNA could find, you know, either stay on Destination America or find another suitor. And you know, I didn't really watch Lucha Underground because I didn't understand Spanish, but it seems like it was a cool product. You know, NXT may be the new big television show. My 21-year-old son, his favorite show is NXT.
Wow.
So, you know, it's really, you know, he's that demographic that's really starting to get back into wrestling. You know, their television is so simple, NXT. They've really taken it down and they simplified it to what made it good 20 years ago. And I don't know if they did that on purpose or they just did that because they had no other choice because all these guys were green. And, you know, but whatever reason they've done it, they've captured an audience, as you could tell in Brooklyn last 2 weeks ago, whenever it was, you know, 13,000 fans to see an NXT show. Who would have ever thought that in a million years? But, you know, my son would love to go to an NXT show, and, you know, that's what that generation is watching. So it's ironic that the biggest and pretty much only company in the world has created their own competition. And,
yeah.
You know, maybe that's the way, that's what they meant to do when they bought WCW, and it didn't work out. But,
I've heard some interviews from top execs that Vince loves that competition piece, and even if it's worth, you know, NXT being sort of a competition, he just loves competition. And I agree with you, just that type of feel that NXT gets. That's why I'm a big fan of ROH as well. So. Great talking to you, sir. Once again, at Dave Penzer on Twitter.
No, at David.
Go follow the guy. At David Penzer. At David Penzer.
Then I have a Facebook fan page at David Penzer WCW. So you can check that out.
There you go. Awesome. At David Penzer on Twitter, right? DavidPenzer @David Penzer.
Yes, sir. You got it.
Awesome. Follow him. And, you know, he'll continue to – I'd imagine the more followers he get, the more interaction he'll have. And
I'm kind of waiting to have a 500, 1,000 people, you know, before I – you know,
there you go.
I have a few – I have a couple hundred now, but – you know, not sort of, you know, a few people remember me, but yeah, come on and hook up. If, enjoy the ride. You're gonna get to see life from a ring announcer's view, I guess.
Awesome. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, David.
It's been fun. Late night with David Benzer.
There you go. Have a good night. Appreciate it.
Take care, buddy.
Bye, everybody.
You are now listening to the Pancakes and Power Slam Show, hosted by Chris Featherstone and Derek of Crave Wrestling. This is the new Tuesday Night Titans.
Awesome, awesome interview from David Penzer, at David Penzer. Fantastic interview. My first time interviewing a ring announcer, and it was awesome. I enjoyed the stories.
The stories were fantastic. This is what you get from Pancakes and Power Slam. We've got Chris Featherstone to thank for bringing these people on here to talk to us. I mean, this guy was—he has stories that would fill 6 hours of, you know, good radio time. So
yeah,
we're blessed to have him with us for an hour. Everything from the best of Pancakes and Power Slams, ladies and gentlemen. This is the place to be. We've got a lot to get to tonight. What are we going to start with, Chris?
What we're going to start with is I have a new confirmation. I said September 15th will be the next interview. It's actually going to be next week and September 15th. I gave a hint of the September 15th interview being a former AWA tag team champion, and he will be there on the 15th. But next week, the 9th. I'm sorry, the 15th, next week, the 8th, we will have a former WWE tag team champion. So, Penzer this week, a former WWE tag team champion next week, and a former AWA tag team champion on the 15th. So, we got a series of interviews, got some October interviews confirmed as well, so we will be announcing the interviews as they go. That was a great times with David Penzer, and I really had a fun time interviewing him. All right, let's get to Raw. Before we get to Raw, of course, I got a few more SummerSlam trivia questions for you. Trivia question number one: who retained the World Heavyweight Championship at SummerSlam 2012? Who retained the World Heavyweight Championship at SummerSlam 2012. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Raw yesterday. Oh, man. Flavor of the Week is going to be, we're just going to just recap all the Tough Enough winners and where are they now type of thing. And I've been going back and forth just with exchanging just contact with one of the former Tough Enough winners. And so I'll let you know who that is when we get to Flavor of the Week. But, yeah, starting with this Sting in-ring promo, I have to write – you know, I chose to write this article on wearewrestling.net or WAWNation.com today or Tuesday about Sting being another pawn in Triple H's game. And I chose to write it on WAWNation because, one, the interaction there is fantastic. I love writing interaction. That's why, you know, writing for the Bleacher Report was great because, you know, just the interaction that I had, thousands of comments and hundreds and upon hundreds of comments throughout each article that I wrote was great. And other wrestling sites that I wrote for too was the interaction was great. I love interacting with fans of my writing, and it's absolutely awesome. So I wrote a pretty long article today on WAWNation.com about Sting being used in this sick, twisted booking charade of putting Triple H over. Now, you know, Ric Flair recently interviewed Steve Austin this week, and they both agreed that Sting should have won at WrestleMania. I think, you know, there's big moments that happen in wrestling, and then you get shocked in the very beginning, and you're like, oh, and you have a certain feeling, a certain impulsive feeling that's, you know, negative and criticizing. And then after some time, you think about, okay, well, maybe it wasn't that bad. But 4 months later, five months later, I feel the same way, and probably even worse, about the outcome of Sting and Triple H. It still was ridiculous, and go to WAWNation.com, check out my article, and if you can read it live now, go there, WAWNation.com. It's called Sting, Just Another Pawn in Triple H's Game. And I comment as well so we can interact. But I was so just after listening to that interview yesterday, I was nauseous. I was so upset. I was nauseous. I was so perturbed by what I saw. First of all, Sting for being 56 looks amazing, by the way. Fantastic shape. There's been reports of him being, you know, getting in the best shape of his life to prepare for his next project in the WWE. And you can definitely tell that Sting, I mean, you know, I'm a personal trainer. I've trained a 62-year-old woman before who was in great shape, who was in good shape, but she ended up being in great shape. Very good endurance that she had. 62 years old, and by the end of our session, she was doing, you know, miles on the treadmill, running miles on the treadmill. And so age isn't necessarily, it doesn't make you, there's not like a cutting point that makes you just worthless as far as the physical, as far as physicality is concerned. So people always say Sting's age, blah, blah, blah. I mean, if you can go, you can go. If you're in the gym, you're in the gym. Yeah, I understand that, you know, body parts and muscles and they deteriorate as you get older. You're more prone to certain things like arthritis and so forth. But if you can go, you can go. And if you can get in the gym and dedicate yourself at 56 years old, do it. by all means, do it. And so you can tell that Sting's doing that. And so if he has it, if he has the endurance, if he has the strength, you can't just say just because he's 56 don't mean, you know, doesn't mean that he can't go anymore. You know, and it's you just can't say stuff like that. It just doesn't make sense to automatically just throw Sting in some type of old pool with a bunch of, you know, senior citizens that, you know, are very immobile. It's just not fair to do that. You could tell Sting's in great shape. But just the interview that happened, the promo that he opened up with, I mean, I felt that Triple H was like, I mean, and people know that I'm a very strong Christian, and so it's like Triple H seemed like the second coming of Christ, you know, based on his promo yesterday. It was sickening, and I know that Sting's a team player. Of course, that wasn't his words that were coming out. I know that most of it was scripted, or at least bullet pointed. And I was so upset by what I saw yesterday. And, you know, it was just a simple promo. It wasn't a run-in. It wasn't anything else. It was just a simple promo of Sting putting the heck over putting over Triple H so much that it seems like he was like a rookie. And it was ridiculous to see. I was nauseated. And it just seems as if, because Sting lost at WrestleMania, And then Triple H came back later on that night on WrestleMania and talked about how Sting is stung, blah, 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 and then goes right into a potential feud with The Rock and Ronda Rousey. So Sting puts Triple H over for Triple H to feud against The Rock. Just like it seems as if, you know, Sting may win the title, that may happen, but at the end of the day, win or lose, Sting again is putting over Triple H. So it's just, it's ridiculous. It's cringe. It was cringeworthy to watch, and I was so just disturbed by that promo.
The promo was bad. It was a bad way to start Raw, because I almost say that was a highlight of Raw, just about. I didn't want to see Sting talk that much. I didn't want to see him, again, put over Triple H like that. And it's just, it's Raw this month, it seems like, just been one giant Triple H show. Granted, Triple H show, however, it was everybody's just, even John Cena, well, last week or whatever, said that, you know, he was never Ric Flair's, you know what. So it's kind of like Triple H is just kind of plugging himself into all these little avenues. And he's using something like Sting. You should not, Sting doesn't need to do stuff like that. He doesn't need to put Triple H over to make Sting look good. What's that do for anything? The guy's there on a limited time, limited basis. This is the last you're going to get from the legendary Sting.
Yeah.
Why have him kiss Triple H's butt like that? I don't like it. The whole thing was just a sham. It was a mockery. I don't want to see Sting talk that much. I don't. He doesn't need to.
I totally agree. Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. Totally, totally agree. And as I mentioned in the article, you know, when they build him and Triple H up in the very beginning, it was reminiscent of his Crow days in WCW. And I loved it. I absolutely loved every minute of it because I've been a Sting fan ever since the late 80s, 86, 87. So nearly 30 years that I've been a Sting fan. So I've watched just about every Sting televised, you know, match. And I'm very astute in the whole Crow, you know, transition. And I love the fact that Sting did not say a single word for a year. That was so well written and so suspenseful and so intriguing. It was absolutely amazing. Now, Sting didn't, you know, it was a span of a few months before he said a word, you know, for WWE. And it was again, suspenseful and intriguing. But if you have him coming out with a Sting t-shirt instead of his trench coat, no bat, just a simple Sting t-shirt, and cuts a promo at the beginning of, why are you tarnishing the mystique? And I've said this before. I said this last week. There's really only two anomalies left in pro wrestling, and that's Sting and The Undertaker. We don't want to know Sting is Steve Borden. We don't want to know The Undertaker is Mark Calloway. It's still that type of superhero and villain type of feel to them. They're still the anomalies. They're still superhuman, you know, so to speak. And it's like we don't want to know that, you know, Bruce Wayne, you know, is Batman. We don't want to know Clark Kent is Superman. And so it's like we don't want to have that feeling. We don't want to know that. It's still that, you know, heroism. It's still that type of feel to Sting and The Undertaker. We don't want to humanize them and just kind of, you know, say whatever to the anomaly that is Sting and The Undertaker. And, man, this week was just a horrible way to keep that mystique of Sting. And I was so distracted. It was ridiculous. Running through Raw real quick, because we're going to talk about Tough Enough here. Dolph Ziggler defeating Rusev. Summer Rae interferes. Lana attacks Summer Rae. And then they have the Beat the Clock Challenge. Becky Lynch won in 3 minutes 21 seconds. Charlotte won in 1 minute 40. And then Paige won, and then Charlotte won. Paige didn't beat the clock because her and Sasha Banks, he didn't beat the clock, so Charlotte became the number one contender. Ryback defeating Big Show because of distracting by Miz. Who really cares about that Intercontinental title feud again? Owens defeating Cesaro. What in the world are they doing with Cesaro, having him lose like that? Again, it's one of those infectious, organic pushes that it seems as if the WWE is just kind of striking down again. I just don't understand that. Braun Strowman defeating Ambrose by DQ. Strowman takes out Reigns. Dudley the Boys defeating New Day. That makes sense to put them into the title picture. And then Rollins has his in-ring promo interrupted by Stephanie McMahon. And then Rollins calls out Sting, but John Cena appears. Rollins doing double duty at SummerSlam. I think that's a great idea. What are your biggest takeaways from Raw, Derek?
My biggest takeaways from Raw is we saw the return of somebody awesome, and that was Tie-Dye Guy in the crowd. Tie-Dye Guy, he was there for every Raw in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then there was a sign that said, "Guy." I was totally stunned. But for the truth, yeah, Raw was boring last night. There wasn't really much happened. It was good to see the Dudleys again over the New Day. And Rollins, Sting, Rollins got double duty. I'm happy with that. I mean, you need to keep this guy relevant. You got to keep him being this sneaky, greasy champion that he is. So, I mean, that helps. Again, to kind of legitimize him, to make him look like he's somebody worthy of the title. But other than that, this really wasn't anything I got from, you got the Dolph Ziggler and Summer Rae. It's ridiculous and boring. It was a SmackDown Raw is what I want to call it. It was a SmackDown Raw last night.
Yeah. Yeah, it was certainly tough to watch. It really was. Again, I don't know what in the world they're doing with Cesaro. For the trivia question, Sheamus retained the World Heavyweight Championship. Next question, who retained the European Championship against Val Venus at SummerSlam 98? Who retained the European Championship against Val Venus at SummerSlam 98? As far as Tie-Dye Guy, I think he had like an interview, a documentary about him like a few years back. And I've seen him just sporadically within the Raws. But yeah, the sign was definitely pretty funny. Snuka, give me 90 seconds on your opinion of Mr. Jimmy Snuka that got arrested. They're reopening his case, and it's funny that Dave Penzer was talking about psychologists, because I'm actually a PhD candidate right now. I think I've said that before. PhD candidate right now. I'll be a doctor in a couple years. Forensic psychology. So all of that just sparks me. I love it. It's I love criminology and forensics and forensic psychology. So I'm. All that just sparks me, and I was, you know, just me being the case guy that I am, just looking further into the Snuka case today, and I knew about the Snuka case, but it, you know, and I always wondered, like, you know, I can't stand unsolved crime, so she died, and, you know, there was, you know, some rumblings of Snuka doing it and so forth, but you know, 32 years later, they reopened the case, and 72-year-old Jimmy Snuka, you know, is in jail with a $100,000 bond. What's going on, Derek?
I can't tell you what's going on. I mean, it's just the biggest shock to me as anyone else. And what's crazy is, like, a month ago, I went to a book fair, and I bought his autobiography, or biography, whatever it was, for $2. I have yet to read it. And I honestly don't remember hearing about this case in Jimmy Snuka's legendary life. And it was like a wow moment. It's like, are you kidding me? It's almost like when Piper passed away. And like, what's going on with our 80s wrestling stars?
Yeah.
Or just 80s stars in general? It's just, don't have much comment. I don't know anything really about this case other than what I've read today. So, like I said, I've got his book. I haven't read it yet, but I'm curious because I read an article today that he briefly talked about it in his book.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to be looking that up, see what's going on. I mean, it's a travesty. If he's guilty, then may he, you know, serve his time and, you know, get his punishment that he deserves. I hate to say that, but, I mean, it's the same thing with, you know, but with Hogan and with, you know, what's going on with all these 80s wrestling stars and just 80s persona stars in general. It's just, you got to be kidding me. This is just another hit in the face. Are you, all my heroes are all of a sudden just coming sleaze bags and scum. It just makes me sick. So, I mean, if he's guilty, then, you know, God forbid, he needs to serve his time. That's exactly what he needs to do. And it's sad. He's got stomach cancer. That just came out not too long ago.
Yeah.
He's a sick old man, but, you know, you do the crime, you do the time.
Absolutely. Totally agree, man. You're batting 1,000 tonight, Derek. I totally agree. You know, you gotta serve it no matter how old you are. I love watching cold cases, and there was a cold case of someone who committed crime in the 60s, and nearly 50 years later, they opened it back up, and they arrested him at his home for the crimes that were committed, the killings that were committed. Almost 50 years later, they arrested him, and he was 70 years old when he got arrested and went to jail. And so, you know, just because, you know, decades go by, doesn't mean, you just get away scot-free with that. So I agree. I mean, if you did it, you got to do it, you know, as far as time is concerned. So certainly. Very, very interesting. I was a big Snuka fan, too. I was a big, huge Jimmy. I was a huge Jimmy Superfly Snuka fan as a kid. I loved his music, too. Super, super, super fly. And, it was awesome. But, you know, hey, it's like you said, what's going on with our 80s, you know, our 80s wrestlers that we looked up to and wanted to emulate as kids. But as we get older and social media becomes more prominent, you know, it's really hard. It's really tough to hide anything, you know, from your past, specifically being a celebrity. So that's what you got to do with Flavor of the Week coming up.
It is now time for the Flavor of the Week.
Real quick, all the Tough Enough winners, the first season, Maven Huffman and Nydia. And then we got the second, the first season and second season was Jackie Gata and Linda Miles or Shaniqua from Basham Brothers. Two women. I don't understand why that happened. Kenny King was the runner-up. Well, Kenny Lane, but Kenny King was the runner-up. And I definitely thought Kenny King should have won that year. The third Tough Enough was John Hennigan, as we know, Johnny Nitro, and Matt Cavatelli, who is the person I've been talking to and keeping in contact with the past few months. He's interested in being interviewed with the show, but some scheduling conflicts. So, Matt Cavatelli is doing some great things. Pewter won season 4. The Miz was the runner-up. And then season 5, of course, was Silent Rage, Annie Levine, and Little Randy Orton. Luke Robinson was the runner-up. Of course, last week we got Sarah Lee and Josh. So out of all of those seasons, Derek, real quick, give me a good 60 seconds of which winner do you remember the most, and which one do you think really got the best out of their Tough Enough win?
The best out of Tough Enough win, I mean, Johnny Nitro, The Miz, obviously, even though he was runner-up. But, I mean, he came from that show, so that's, you know, he went on. I remember Nydia mostly for the trailer park thing that she did with James Noble.
Yeah.
and that was good. That was fun. They went together fine. That was perfect. And I really enjoyed that. I remember Maven. I just, he had like kind of a sob story, came from nothing, and he was all proud of his mom. So that was a good touching moment. But really, I mean, Tough Enough, I mean, it hasn't really made its niche into WWE as the impact as I think they wanted it to. because it seems like, you know, other than what's his name? I think Matt, the announcer, was the announcer in WWE for a while.
Yeah, Joey Matthews.
Joey Matthews, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's had success. I mean, he wasn't a wrestler per se. He was more of, you know, a backstage announcer type of guy. But, I mean, Tough Enough itself is, the show is not too bad for a wrestling fan, but really there's hasn't really been that big of a reward for the winners. And
yeah.
Then you get some TV time, but then they kind of fall off the face of the earth, so.
Yep.
That's my take on.
Absolutely. Well said. Not very much that came out of Tough Enough. Like you said, a handful of people that has done something in the WWE, a lot of them in the indies, but, you know, we'll see. We'll see what Josh and Sarah Lee does. I'm interested to see their future and what they're going to do with them. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a fantastic ride with you all tonight. David Pinzer, our host, fantastic job. Thank you, David, again. Follow him at David Pinzer. And again, next week, interviewing a former WWE Tag Team Champion. It'll be a very, very, very interesting interview. We've talked on the phone a few times, very excited about it. And it's going to be very interesting. I'm looking forward to talking to this guy. So looking forward to being with you all next week. Until then, enjoy your week of wrestling. God bless. Day loves Ian and Elijah. And you enjoy your week. Bye-bye.